All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Yeah, and a welcome 2017, our first live program here at our flagship station, WAAM Talk Radio Ann Arbor, the big 1600. Yes, I'm back. It's been a while. Dale is taking the afternoon, evening off. He's got a little bit, I think he had to go on sick call there. Maybe get a little bit of that nice cough medicine that we used to always get. But I hope you're feeling better, Dale, and I know everybody's going to be feeling better today. We've got Dr. Rebecca Grant coming on the program. I know how y'all like that. That's right. She's going to answer all those questions about China, North Korea, ICBMs, and the President Trump response, the Twitter effect. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, we're going to have a good time with that. She'll be with us in just a minute, but before we go, if we get a notice from you folks, we can give it a shout out to our vast audience. And this particular one is going to be in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Now, those of you listening to us in Australia or California, well, what do I need to do about that? Well, it's part, though, of the Warriors and Caregivers United, WACU.org. WACU.org, Warriors and Caregivers United. They're going to have a fundraiser on January the 11th in Ypsilanti, Michigan, over at Frenchie's Bar and Grill. Going to be great food, great entertainment. They have a former Miss Michigan, Stacy Manson. Boy, that gal can really play a fiddle. Ooh, man, she can play. She'll be giving a little bit of a concert for us. It's going to be great auction items. So all the money goes, the donations go to Warriors and Caregivers United.org. That's WACU.org. Hey, send these folks a little check, huh? They do great stuff. Something else, too, I notice here that started a few years back. We don't say the D anymore. That's right. It's not a disease. It's not a disorder. Just PTS, plain old stress. That's right. So let's deal with that. That's exactly what's on the flyer here. PTS, exactly. And learn how to deal with it. Okay, Bob Gould will be coming back in just a moment with Dr. Rebecca Grant. And looking at my producer, Chauncey, take it away. And we're back to you here from Veterans Radio Live, WAAM 1600 Talk Radio, Ann Arbor, Michigan, our flagship station, also on the internet, and you can find us all over the place. Yes. Okay. Well, Dr. Rebecca Grant has been beginning our programming for, I believe this is now the fourth or fifth year that she has begun the year for us, and is going to kind of set the tone because there's so much going on politically. Dr. Grant was a director of the General Billy Mitchell Institute for Air Power Studies. That's at the Air Force Association, and she's also a contributing editor for Air Force Magazine. I looked it up, and before we go, I know I want to get a subscription. I had a problem how being able to do that, but we'll straighten that out. Dr. Grant is also senior fellow at the Lexington Institute. She earned her PhD in international relations from the London School of Economics and has worked for RAND, the RAND Corp, and United States Air Force. In 1995, Dr. Grant founded IRIS, Independent Research, and I got that right here. It's a public policy research organization in Washington, D.C. And looking at other things, oh, Dr. Grant in 2012 also spoke out on the hypoxia issues of the Lockheed Martin F-22. What I'm leading to, folks, is this person is very qualified to talk about the things that we're going to be talking about. Dr. Grant, welcome to 2017 Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob. I'm glad to be back with you. Happy New Year and happy, exciting 2017.
Ah, where to start? I I started this morning to try to put some kind of outline together, and it's just impossible. So I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit here. But the first thing I want to do, which really caught my attention the last time Dr. Grant was on the program back in October, she talked about Mosul, that there was a huge battle going on, and it was like the Gettysburg. The two sides were locked in combat, and there was nothing in the news. It didn't even get front page news. I don't know what happened. What happened at Mosul, Dr. Grant?
Well, Mosul is still going on. I'm so glad you brought that up. We talked about that back in October when the a largely Iraqi force had begun an offensive to take back the city of Mosul, which is one of the major cities of Iraq there on the Tigris River. This offensive is led by the Iraqis, but very much assisted by the United States and the coalition. They help them out with some ground planning, and they also help out with air power. And I was just looking over some of the numbers for what's going on over in Syria and Iraq today, and it's really, really striking. The operation is called Operation Inherent Resolve, and the whole thing really started actually two and a half years ago now, back in late 2014. And the number of airstrikes that our U.S. Airmen, Air Force, Marines, Navy, and then our coalition partners has increased so much. In looking at it overall, in 2014, they did about 2,000 airstrikes in which they dropped a bomb. There were more than that. There were total missions flown were much higher. But so 2,000 in 2014, and then in 2015, it was 9,912 bomb-dropping sorties. And then this past year in 2016, keeping up that pace with 10,770 bomb-dropping sorties flown. I followed this and I was astonished. I didn't realize that they were at that high a level of activity. Really, really some remarkable achievements there by our airmen and the people who support them on the ground.
Where's the basis for these planes?
These bases are all over the Persian Gulf region. You know, we have a big base in Qatar, which is, spelled with a Q, Q-A-T-A-R, but pronounced Qatar. We have other bases around the region. And what's unique about Operation Inherent Resolve is there are over 40 nations that are part of this coalition. And for the first time, we've seen some of our Arab and Persian Gulf state partners and allies also participating in this campaign. So it's really a big effort, and what they're trying to do is to degrade the ISIL, the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant and Syria that kind of spreads across northern Iraq and through parts of Syria. They're trying to push them back, and they're being very successful. And so Mosul is the latest major area of fighting on the ground as they try to take that back. And they're also moving up a little bit north in those operations. Again, mostly Iraqi and Kurdish and other ground forces supported by the coalition fighters and bombers doing their airstrikes.
Now, folks, if I'm going to take about 1 minute here to let this all started way back when I remember when the Obama administration took office, that President Assad was a real chazer. I mean, this guy just didn't take care of his people, and he was a despot. And we supported the rebels to overthrow Assad. You're still getting those folks, right? Now, from what I got, we're fighting the rebels, the very same people that we supported. Tell us about that.
Oh, you're right. You're starting to get that lay down, and it's so complicated. Rebels fighting against Assad, but there are a number of different rebel groups. Of course, don't forget, and we're going to talk about him later, but the Russians under Putin helping to support Assad. And then, of course, our Iraqi forces, Iraqi government, and then independent Kurdish Iraqi forces on the good guy side. Also on the good guy side, some selective groups of Syrian rebels. So everyone who's against this Islamic State, this is the group that rose up out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and has become much, much bigger than that ever was, and they're trying to put an Islamic State, a caliphate, over this territory of Iraq and Syria. And they were pretty successful to start with, but now they are failing. And this is the group that also pushes out the terrorists up in the refugee flows and makes all the pronouncements about sparking terrorist incidents around the world. So major league bad guys, very interesting coalition of good guys with us there as well, trying to support that. And just looking over what they did yesterday in the theater, 34 strikes against targets, and it's a variety, but it's what you'd expect. They're striking ground positions. They blew up a UAV. They shut down a supply route. And a lot of this is trying to make sure that this Islamic State isn't able to exploit the black market in oil in that region, which they've done very successfully. They ran a huge oil smuggling operation that's helped finance their activities both in Iraq and Syria and, unfortunately, abroad. So these airstrikes help to support the ground forces clearing out the area and also to go ahead and break up the oil smuggling and other things that ISIS is trying to do.
Who do the bad guys sell the oil to?
Each other, and oddly enough, even to the good guys, and then down into Iran, everybody buys oil. So it's a very, very, very complicated situation. But the coalition has been pretty successful in making it much harder for them to move the quantities of oil that have financed their operation. So that's part of the good news of the air and ground operations going on in Operation Inherent Resolve.
But we can embark, we can put up a blockade, could we not, with our ships and our air force to stop this oil being delivered, cutting off their money, which cuts off their supplies. That's it. How am I wrong with that?
Oh, you're right, and that's absolutely it. The thing that leaks out, though, is the smuggling, and some of this is done. It's done with trucks. One even hears reports of it being done by donkey and pack animal. So there are always ways, especially in an urban setting, to kind of move this oil out. And it takes a long time to figure out, you know, where the new smuggling route is. Very, very tough. But, again, they're having some success there. And best of all, we've certainly seen the Iraqi Kurds very successful in pushing through and clearing out most of their traditionally Kurdish territory in northern Iraq. And then the area of ISIS control around the major cities is diminishing. Still going to take some time, but the Inherent Resolve, I think, is kind of a good name for this operation, because both the Obama administration and the incoming Trump administration have signaled that we will continue. We have no choice. We have to fight here and keep this going.
Sounds like we have a Ho Chi Minh trail being formed here for this oil business, and maybe that's when our Air Force could make an intervention, eh?
You're right. It's very similar to that, and it's just about as hard to really stop. The terrain's not the same. You know, it's not a jungle, but it's just as difficult working around, you know, what they call the urban jungle, right? Working around those areas, both finding out where things are really going and how to strike effectively. Of course, the huge concern here, too, for the coalition is to not cause destruction of civilian property and to limit civilian casualties wherever possible. Luckily, we have a lot more precision weapons. They can do that. But it takes time, and it does make it harder to use both the ground and air power. You know, and we have field artillery pieces over there as well working on this. So I think, you know, I want your listeners to understand this is really quite an active war, something that we should be really proud of what our service members across all the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, obviously Special Forces too, are really participating in this along with our allies. So a lot going on in combat every day over there.
Well, and I want one other thing I do want to cover, that from what I remember, that we supported Russia to send this to support Assad because the Russians would put the boots on the ground. We didn't want to do that. We did the airstrikes. Sounds like that's what we've been doing by your data that you were talking about earlier, and this has been successful. Is that true?
That's true to some extent, but a lot of the boots on the ground success is from the Iraqi army, you know, Iraq democratically elected government, we have assisted in training that Iraqi army. Some ups and downs there, but they've done a good job in providing boots on the ground and clearing the part of their own country where ISIS is strong. Now, up in Syria, we see a mix of actors, rebels, Russians, etc. Sometimes our interests overlap with those of the Russians, sometimes not. Our defense secretary recently said he's just not real happy with how the Russians have upheld their part of this operation. And a lot of suspicion there about, you know, how that will turn out. But there has been good news. We talked about Mosul and in that area. So in the Iraqi territory, this is all going a bit better. Syria remains very, very complex, indeed, in attempting to both figure out what the long-term solution is there to try to stem some of the refugee flow and to root out the ISIS caliphate that is in Syria. So, and we see the our airstrikes of pride in both areas, both what is currently Iraqi territory and what we would think of also as Syrian territory. So very, very tough situation. I'm sure we'll be talking about it all through 2017.
Well, Syria and Russia right now started sharing borscht and making nice. What's going on here?
Oh, my goodness. You know, what's going on here?
Sharing borscht.
Sharing borscht.
And kishka, those of you that know what that is, right? That's a Russian dish. Interesting.
Yes, that's right.
But they're making nice. What's going on?
They are longtime allies, of course. As you know, Russia has long backed Assad and supplies equipment there. The Russians have been very involved back from the effort a few years ago to secure potential chemical weapons that were there so they wouldn't be used. And then, of course, there's the big picture as far as Russia is concerned. Russia has forces based in Syria supporting the government. And this is part of Russia's re-entry onto the world stage, a very, very big part of it, because the basing in Russia of air and ground forces and the naval operations really makes them a major military player in that part of the conflict, and that is exactly what Putin wants at this point in time. He wants to be a major military player, and in Syria, he is.
So, we're lining up. And we're like, well, what about the Kurds? where do they come into all this? Who's, again, they're part of the coalition, but have they been actively fighting?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is a resounding yes. They have been very, very active. They have actually, the Kurds were the first to push the ISIS influence out of their region. The Kurds really have a very strong fighting force. They were very helpful in overthrowing Saddam Hussein way back when in the 2003 operations and what followed. So they have used their ground units, supported with coalition air power, to go and make sure that the Kurdish regions are basically free of this caliphate nonsense. Now, very interesting, the Kurds have long been part of Iraq, but it's a very unique and separate culture, and the Kurds have said that they fought to clear their territory, and they don't want to return necessarily to a Shia-dominated Iraqi state. So they are talking like they'd like to see a partition of a sort of an independent Kurdish region, and they have they fought to get that. So how that turns out in the long run, I think, is a little unclear. But right now, the Kurds are doing a tremendous job in opposing the Islamic State forces. They're really very, very effective, excellent fighters. You know, we owe them a round of thanks. They're really doing a great job.
Are we providing the Kurds with their supplies?
We are providing them with assistance, yes. I think there's been some training assistance, supplies as well. It looks to me like a well-established military cooperation relationship there. And then, of course, something that is more broadly supported through our support of the Iraqi-led forces. So, you know, this is what the Kurds have done is kind of exactly what we want to see, which is these are people who live in this region and care about it, and they're taking the lead with support from the U.S. and the coalition, but they're taking the lead in stamping down terrorism in their own towns and cities. So that's exactly what we want to see.
How about it, folks? Yeah. Why don't we just take a real quick PSA. Give us a quick, Dr. Grant will be right back. Give yourself a quick drink of water and we'll take a little, we got a stretch. He's telling me to stretch. Okay. How much time? 30 seconds? Yeah, so I stretch it for 30 seconds. Dr. Grant, go ahead and get yourself a drink of water now. We're with Dr. Rebecca Grant. Coming live to you from Washington, D.C., and we're talking about Syria and Russia and North Korea, and anybody that knows, China's coming up, too. So you ready? Go ahead. Hit that. We'll be right back. There we go. Everybody had themselves a little bit of a break, and we're back here on Veterans Radio here at WAAM Talk Radio 1600 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. With us right now is Dr. Rebecca Grant talking about the world. Oh, we have five. Good. I just got the five signal. Wonderful. We're going to be going to the news in 5 minutes, right? We got all that. Okay. Now, I got some information here that there was the ceasefire truce that was brokered by Russia and Turkey. Why don't you tell us in about 5 minutes about that? I mean, how can, are they partnered? What's the story?
Oh, and what day is it? Who's a partner?
Yeah.
Who and what day? And which peace settlement is going on? Well, this one is very interesting for a couple of reasons. And I think, you know, one of the first reasons that's so interesting is this is widely reported as the peace settlement that was brokered without the U.S. being at the table. So this was an agreement, you know, that comes from late 2016. And although Secretary of State John Kerry has been incredibly active and logged, you know, thousands and thousands of miles, he was not at the table for this one, and so the U.S. was not at the table. So very, very, very interesting. Who stepped in to do this was Turkey's President Erdogan and, of course, Putin as well. They have gotten very close over the last year or so. Particularly, you know, Turkey under Erdogan, who is, he's a strongly religious Muslim figure, and has been elected multiple times as leader of Turkey. He has really cozied up to Russia in a way that's a bit surprising because Turkey is, of course, a member of NATO and a major country in the region with a very long, very cosmopolitan history. So it's been interesting watching that. Recently, of course, after the ceasefire, there was the tragedy of Russia's ambassador to Turkey being gunned down at an art gallery in Istanbul, just a horrible killing. So a lot of shades of darkness within this, but this was an attempt really by Putin to be that player on the world stage. So it's a feather in Putin's cap to be off brokering a deal with Erdogan, who represents, of course, a NATO ally. So Putin here is getting the kind of ceasefire that he wants, but also really sticking it in the eye of the U.S. and of the NATO alliance, which NATO is not Putin's favorite thing. So he really gets one up on NATO by going off and brokering this ceasefire. Now, then the question, you know, and the typical reports read, most of Syria is quiet since the ceasefire, but, you know, there's always fighting that goes on. So the ceasefires are a little bit like window dressing, I have to say. I mean, they can be effective for a while, but they tend never to last, and they never really cover the whole fighting in the region. So even when these ceasefires take place, it may be between just a few of the factions and part of the Assad forces, and it may not even affect the larger coalition fight against other parts of the ISIS caliphate forces. So you just really got to ask yourself. And so I think you see this mainly as an example of diplomatic posturing by Putin, with Erdogan going along as he sort of looks towards what Turkey's future role will be. Turkey, of course, extremely affected by refugee flows and by the cross currents of the Syrian conflict, by the cross currents caused by the presence of the Islamic State. Turkey has been very, very impacted by this They remain a great NATO ally, but lots of questions about Turkey's future. And these funny ceasefire agreements really, I think, make those questions even more serious. But clearly, Putin acting on the world stage, dragging Turkey's Erdogan along towards who knows what end.
Okay, that's our band got up for the break. Dr. Grant, we'll be right back. And folks, don't you go away. This is Bob Gould with Veterans Radio coming to you live from WAAM Talk Radio, 1600 Ann Arbor, Michigan. Don't you go away. And we're back to you live on Talk Radio 1600, Veterans Radio. Bob Gould here with Dr. Rebecca Grant from Washington, D.C., talking about everything Washington, D.C., everything, and to do with the Air Force. North Korea, they're crazy there. That's a tinderbox. The person in charge, Kim Jong-un, well, he's a little unpredictable. Now, there's ICBMs here being involved, and President-elect Trump. What's going on here, Dr. Grant?
Well, Bob, the first thing that we want to note is that today is Kim Jong-un's birthday.
Hey, mazel tov.
So happy birthday. No one knows how old he is. They think he's 33 or 34. He certainly has that puffy baby face. So there's so much we don't know about him. But he did, I think that he had a big military parade and who knows what all he did. But anyway, he's claiming it's his birthday, and so I knew you'd want to know that. Much more in the news is he's not only claiming that it's his birthday, but that North Korea is now claiming that they are able to put a nuclear warhead on an intercontinental range missile. So very interesting. This came about in December, and Washington has acknowledged that they think they do have the capability to launch a nuclear weapon. There's a caveat. You'll be glad to know. The caveat is they're not sure whether this missile could survive the heat and friction of reentry into the Earth's atmosphere. Is one. The second caveat, the intelligence community is not sure whether North Korea has a guidance package on that missile that would enable it to hit a target.
Well,
I'm not sure that makes me feel much better, though. I don't know. How about you, Bob?
Right.
Feel any better?
No, it doesn't. But that duck and cover, here we go. But that puts Japan in jeopardy, does it not?
Well, Japan, exactly, a good point. When we look at North Korea's capabilities, we talk a lot about can they reach U.S. bases like Guam or, heaven forbid, Hawaii, and in what year would they be able to reach the west coast of the United States, et cetera. And, of course, we all know they can reach Japan now, okay? And, again, the guidance is very uncertain. There have been some successful missile launches by North Korea. Some have been more successful than others. What we know they're able to do is to drag a rocket out and hurl this thing up into, the upper atmosphere, and it reenters. We're not sure how good their guidance is. But the thing that's concerning about this, of course, is, and this is what President-elect Trump responded to, is the idea that they could pair up a nuclear weapon and a missile. Hey, back in the Cold War, that was a sign when you could see that the Russians of the 1950s or 1960s were developing a system and could put that warhead on it. That was worrying. We worried about that with Iraq, decades ago, and that's really the sign. So it's a very concerning sign. This official that went on the record but without using their name said, this is really the threat that keeps you awake at night. Now, countering that, there's a lot to keep in mind. One, we do have a number of U.S. forces in Korea still, about 28,000. And as our Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, says, hey, these guys, they're ready to fight tonight. So We have that. We do have some good ballistic missile defenses around those Korean bases and, of course, protecting Guam, plus some sea-based missile defenses. And we have a ground-based interceptor system here in the U.S., based primarily out of Alaska, that is designed to intercept a small missile attack. So, you know, we're preparing, but it's certainly a very, very concerning development.
Well, and something else, folks, to keep in mind, which was brought to my attention, and I think this is very, very, possible, is that if something were to happen to Kim Jong-un, that there would be a huge influx of refugees from the north to the south because the big dog would be gone. And that would overwhelm all the systems in South Korea. Can you give us just a minute or two on that, Dr. Grant?
Yes, that refugee crisis. I think most people who follow North Korea expect the North Korean regime to collapse at some point. I'm not talking next month, next year, but at some point in time. And so we worry about the nuclear piece of this, in part because there's a concern that conflict between North and South Korea, or if there's a preemptive strike by an international coalition, that this could cause the collapse of North Korea's regime. And what that presents you with immediately is a country that is already on bare minimum subsistence. And so this is a problem of, one, how do you secure any other military forces or military sites? How do you get in there and find any nuclear weapons that they may have, find those missiles, and safe them so that they can't be used in a retaliation or a last act or for revenge or something? Then how do you take care of that population? How do you start flying in relief supplies? How do you take care of that population that has been starved of information and food for so long? And, of course, the question here, too, is what role is China playing? You know, we know they have a very, very close relationship. Some sophisticates speculate that China kind of likes having North Korea bother the Americans and that the U.S.-China relationship, as it fluctuates, can have an impact on North Korea, because if the Chinese are more cross with the Americans, they'll be less willing to keep North Korea in check. So, big issue there. And then, of course, the thing that's a little bit new in the news stories is President-elect Trump saying, no way are we going to let them develop a nuclear ICBM capability. And that's led everybody to wonder, is there any chance that there would be a preemptive strike if the North Koreans roll a launcher out onto the pad? Would the Americans, in consultation with our top allies in the UN, would we try to do something to destroy that capability? A little bit like how the Israelis destroyed an Iraqi nuclear reactor way back when. So is there a chance of a preemptive strike?
Is
a lot boiling in that pot right now.
You have my attention. Is there? I know we can't really ask you that, but, I mean, off the record, something, comment. I'm here on the edge of the precipice listening to this, and what is the possibility of that? Sounds to me that that's probably going to be what's going to go down. Am I right? Wrong?
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I mean
the guy's dangerous.
He is, and he's unpredictable. Most new presidents get a pretty big unexpected foreign policy crisis in their first year in office, right? Because the world's a busy, dangerous place. So it's not impossible that this is a question that President Trump may confront sometime in his first few years in office, right? This could absolutely be a question he confronts. And here's what he would be looking for. He would be looking for a military option that could guarantee destruction of the capability, not cause a huge unnecessary amount of civilian casualties in North Korea, and something that he could execute within the timeline of that missile sitting out on the pad. So it's tough, but it's a bomber mission. I mean, you know, I'm a real follower of the U.S. Bomber Force, and this is something that, you know, we do have the capability to do this. It's not easy, but we do have people that are trained to be able to at least present options like this to the president. So when we talk about being able to reach out and strike a target anywhere on the face of the earth rapidly, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. You know, to be able to have that capability, this is something we would do for the greater interest of the whole world. And, yeah, I mean, these are options that the people will think about and research how they may be presented to the president should that become necessary.
And what is the Air Force's position on what China would do in case of that?
Well, it's a very interesting question there, too. And I think that's more an issue for that's more of almost the State Department of wondering how that would play in the larger China relationship. But, you know, real questions there. Our policy with China has been to try to improve military-to-military contacts, but we also know that it's turned into a real rivalry. And, in fact, you know, I love to talk about that Chinese aircraft carrier. Well, that thing has been very, very active this past couple weeks. They actually sailed past Okinawa, so you know they wanted to be seen and talked about and all that. China continues to build up its bases down around the Philippines in the South China Sea in that area. And they made a very interesting comment to me. China used to come out and talk about their own carrier and how great it was. And then recently they came out and talked about how bad the U.S. Navy was. And their planes aren't very good and their ships are old. And of course none of that's true. But I thought it was a very interesting turn in the war of words, if you will, showing just a little bit more bristling, a little bit more posturing than we've seen in the past from China.
Well, let's hold it right there, and we're going to go to a quick PSA breaks, and I do have a question coming back to you, Dr. Grant. We're going to, well, I'll save it for then. We'll be right back right after these very important messages. And we're back on Veterans Radio right here on Talk Radio 1600 WAAM. And with us is Dr. Rebecca Grant, who's been commenting on Air Force strategy, what's going on in the Middle East, what's going on in China. My question right now, and I made this comment to a friend yesterday, and this may be a little far out, but I see China becoming our strongest ally. What do you think about that?
Very, very interesting. There's a dance going on. China, Russia, the U.S. We used to know exactly where everybody stood in that game, but things are really shifting around. And the questions, some people talk about, well, will China and Russia get closer together? Will China and the U.S. get closer together? Will Russia and the U.S. get closer together? Any one of these things could happen, or none, over the next couple of years. So could China become an ally? Very, very interesting there. But there's certainly are some issues that both bind us and divide us with China. We are bound by our big mutual economic interests. It's a big market for U.S. companies. Equally, China really counts on the exports that they send to us. So very strong economic relationship. Not a perfect one by any means, but it's powerful for all, in both good and bad. The question is what China really wants in terms of its world position in the Pacific. They have been much, much, much more aggressive. We know that their military spending has increased enormously. The sophistication of that spending has increased. And then another area that's really worrying is the potential for competition in space. We actually had, this past year, our government set up a new space operations center called, it's a big long acronym, but it's called the JIXBOC. And its purpose is to prepare for combat operations in space. Now, this consists largely of looking at satellites, both ours and theirs, seeing who is where, and taking defensive and, if necessary, offensive measures, should this become necessary, so that we can continue to use space for communication, navigation, observation, all those kind of things. But it's a big deal that there's a new center trying to secure the space domain. And the actor that we're securing that from is China. So just to be clear. So back here on Earth in the Pacific with the building of bases that China is doing, they've taken some very, very tiny reefs and islands, dredged and poured concrete and created a runway, an active combat runway on one, creating a big harbor in another. So they want to have the ability to use their air and naval forces around key areas of the Pacific. So how are we going to divide that line? How will we continue to deter Chinese presence in the Pacific? That's a huge defense question that we're dealing with right now.
Why even deter it? Let them do it. I mean, it is what it is. They are what they are. I mean, at some point, we just can't be taking everybody out. And I see China and the U.S. sharing, especially economics. I also see them sharing the space ventures. I know you were mentioning that. I didn't think about the defense part. I was thinking about flying to Mars and all the trillions of dollars of resources there. And we can't do it alone. We can't financially do it alone. We're certainly not going to do it with the Bolsheviks. I know that ain't going to happen. And who's left? But it's the Japanese and the Chinese. And I see the Chinese. They have everything. They got stealth. They have aircraft carriers. They got boats. They've got missiles. To me, it's a rhetorical question. Why push it anymore? It is what it is. They're going to do what they're going to do. We're certainly not going to deter them by what? Economic? Tell us about that.
Well, then that's the question. You know, as the economic power of China grows, and China is just returning to the place that they held in ancient history a long time back, you know, before the early 1800s, they were a world power such that we had those things back then. And in a way, they're just coming back to a position that they rightfully hold by virtue of their sophisticated culture and their population. The thing is, there are a lot of other nations in that region that we have alliances with, and do you think Australia, Japan, are other treaty allies. And so it's about how do we balance in this multipolar world. We're not kind of used to that. We're used to either being enemies with a nation or friends. There's kind of an area in between where the U.S. and China fit in the military sense, and I think we will be deterring them for a long time. We do that with our Navy, which just, the USS Carl Vinson, an aircraft carrier, is just off to deploy out to the Western Pacific. We do that with our Air Forces stationed on Guam. And I think that at this point in time, it's better that we do that because we reassure our allies, whether that is Japan, Australia, et cetera. We do reassurance that way, and we assure then that the balance does not become all China all the time. The concern is, what if China were to try to blockade or make it more difficult or on purpose or accidentally cause conflict in some of the territorial disputes in the Pacific? Would we be drawn in? You know, we probably would be. And so we're trying to really just deter all that and make sure that we maintain enough military strength in the Pacific that China doesn't overreach.
Well, it sounds to me like it's the beginning of a marriage. Sometimes it gets a little rocky as we go along. However, we're going to keep tabs on that. And remember, folks, you heard it first here. That's right, because it just all seems to be fitting in. But let's get back to President-elect Trump and his economic policy, his military policy. And I want to ask Dr. Grant right now. Now, we've got some airplanes involved. In fact, he made a comment on the F-35. He was talking about to the Boeing folks, things are way out of hand, and that I was looking at cost overruns here for the F-35, and I always thought that I wonder what, and I'd like you to comment on that. The costs have been so hugely increased that I would think that they would go down as production. Henry Ford said that the more cars I make, the cheaper it costs me to build them. So that's number one. We want to talk about that very quickly. And the NGB, the next generation bomber, what about that? What about the Buff? You all know what the Buff is, right? The B-52. What's going to happen to these? Are they going to wind up on the chopping block because they're ancient as to what the Air Force's best guess to what the Trump, President Trump military budget's going to be? Tell us about that.
Hey, I like a man who quotes Henry Ford, and he was right about the Model T, and he's right about F-35. So they are going down in cost. You know, the thing that's made the F-35 so expensive is that we've bought them so slowly. If you buy just a few every year and you keep that production line there waiting and all those the skilled touch labor and engineers around, well, then they're going to cost more. But we are starting to see the F-35 do what we expected it to do. It's really neat. It came, it reached its operational capability with the Air Force this year, meaning they have a couple squadrons that are ready to go to war or deploy if they need to. Israel took delivery of a couple of F-35s just back in December, a very big deal. Plane's doing great. The jet is great. The program, you know, it's like any major defense program. And remember, it's an airplane program for three different services. So it's really three airplane programs, plus our allies are buying it, too. So that's part of the reason for the cost. As to Trump, oh, so fascinating here in Washington. You just see anything in Twitter, and he tweets out on the F-35. He tweeted out on Air Force One, and everybody jumps. So it's going to be interesting to see how we all accommodate that in this new world that we're in. But I have to say, Bob, he is asking the right questions. Don't we all want to know how the F-35 got so expensive? Don't we all want to know how Air Force One got so expensive? But the thing is, it's very, a friend of mine said, it's almost like Socrates. It's a dialogue. We're not used to that from a politician. We're used to a politician, especially a president, coming out with a policy position and saying, hey, this is what we think. You know, and this man's asking questions, and we've got to get used to that. So now the answers rely on more detail. Kind of told you how things got where they are in F-35, and I hope he and his administration will look for the answers as well as asking the questions. One thing that's going to be big in his defense policy is whether he continues to support the B-21, the new bomber, which is named the Raider in homage to the Doolittle Raiders who flew B-25s off the deck of the USS Hornet and struck Japan in 1942. Great name. The bomber is on track. It's going to be a few years till we hear more about that program as they go into serious development with Northrop Grumman, and a few years even more until we see one. I'm longing to see one, but it'll be a little while. We still need that bomber largely because the buff is old, and our B-2s, a great stealth bomber, we only have 20 of them, as you know, and we need to be able to bring that firepower to bear so that we can hold targets like North Korean ICBM launchers at risk if we need to. That bomber program is a good stabilizing force. It really increases our deterrence, both in conventional and the nuclear realms, and something we really need to do. So I'm glad to see that continuing. The Air Force has asked, you know, there's an idea that we'll get some larger defense budgets in Washington. There's a lot of bills to pay. We have a lot of ongoing war bills and some repairing and rebuilding to do in the readiness accounts. So hard to say how much real growth we'll see in defense, but the Air Force Chief of Staff is hoping that one thing he can do is add some additional airmen so to improve the quality of life, especially in the units that deploy a lot. He wants to kind of ease the manpower shortage. The Chief of Staff of the Army has asked for the same thing, to increase the number of Army soldiers because of the constant rotations, which now include Europe. You know, we have more Army forces in Europe than we've had for a while. And then the Navy is hoping to increase its ship buying and buy some more submarines and also some more cruiser and destroyer types over time. Whether any of that comes to fruition, we'll have to see. But those are the immediate outlines of the plans that we're seeing under the incoming Trump administration.
Is the Twitter effect going back to the fireside chat, is this the equivalent of the fireside chat back in World War II?
Yes, this is the fireside chat on steroids, I'm telling you.
Amen.
That is exactly what it is. And it's exactly. It is the fireside chat.
I mean, Roosevelt, it was a bully radio program. Instead of bully pulpit, it was bully airwaves. That's what he did. And I'm seeing the same thing here. Is that true?
Yeah, that is so true. And not since those fireside chats have we had people listening. I think many presidents between Roosevelt and Trump have done weekly radio broadcasts and things like that, but man, Trump has just knocked it out of the park with Twitter and with his other use of media. So he clearly has a passion for speaking directly to the American people, and I do mean directly.
We have less than 3 minutes to go, and something that's very close to home, this will be the final question of the day, evening, would be our local Air Force Base, Selfridge Air Force Base, which is about 60 miles from where I'm sitting right now, and they are about to take command or one of a squadron of F-35s if everything goes through. And of course it's a real big issue economically for the area. Otherwise there was talk about closing the base. Oh, we only got 2 minutes. So comment on the F-35 going to be deployed. What's the chances of all that? Or is the thing going to be half scrap? What's going on?
No, you'll see F-35s going in, and that's a great move. If that would be a great move for Selfridge, absolutely. Number one reason, you get the skilled maintainers, and these are great reserve component jobs. You really need skilled people to be able to maintain these advanced aircraft, and that would be a super, super match, especially with Selfridge's long, wonderful history. It's a great transition and really, really good for the unit there. So this would be just the best of all possible worlds to see F-35s going in at Selfridge. That would be an excellent, excellent thing.
Want to thank you very much for beginning. Oh, there's the orchestra. They're getting up right now. And they're warming up their instruments, and we're getting ready to say goodbye and good night. Dr. Grant, thank you again for beginning another season for Veterans Radio. Outstanding how you can do it for 55 minutes. It's a real marathon. We want to thank you, and thank you for always being available.
Super. Thank you, Bob. Really enjoyed it.
Well, we enjoy having you on the program. Well, folks, next week, Dale will be back. Hopefully, if he's not on sick call. G.I. Gin, that's what we used to call that cough medicine. Got a little G.I. Gin. I think it had 12% alcohol. We had a good time with that going out in the field. I was a medic, so, you know, the guys would come in. Yeah, okay. So, Bob Gould, Dale Thronberry, Nina Golding-Diaz, we'll see you next week. Until then, you all are dismissed.